a regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking with Mike Harris from the Gun Owners Action League up in Massachusetts about, about a lot of things, actually. We've got a bill that we are eyeing. Similar to the bill that's in effect and is being challenged in California that imposes an 11% excise tax on firearms and ammunition, in addition to the federal excise tax of 11%. Colorado also has done this as well. I think their tax is 6.5% on all firearms and ammunition. And other blue states, I think, are going to be doing this as well. Massachusetts has this bill that not only would impose an 11% tax on all firearms and ammunition, but if you purchased ammunition or firearms out of state, you would be expected to pay tax in Massachusetts on an item that you did not buy in Massachusetts. I mean, I guess it's good that this bill is so poorly written that it can automatically be challenged on that ground alone. But anyway, we start there with Mike Harris, but this is a wide-ranging conversation. We're talking a lot about what's going on with the latest litigation over Chapter 135, and even some good news out of the town meetings in Massachusetts, which is kind of a unique tradition in the state where basically once a year there is a public meeting. Residents of towns all across the state get together and they vote on a variety of issues. It's an opportunity to actually claw back to at least some small degree our right to keep and bear arms. And again, we've got some good news to report from town meeting season. So take a look and a listen. Mike, thanks very much for coming on the program. It's good to see you.
Yeah, you too, man. Anytime.
I like the Sox hat, by the way, even though the Sox aren't in the playoffs. At least the Yankees got knocked out, too,
it's,
right?
So exactly. That... it's just solidarity with whoever beats the Yankees. That's what this in the postseason when they're not there, this just means whoever beats the Yankees.
Exactly. So my colleague Tom Knighton wrote about this bill a couple of days ago. It sounds like it's very similar to what's already in place in California, right? An additional 11% excise tax on firearms and ammunition. There's an interesting quirk in this bill that if you go out of state to buy ammunition or a firearm, I guess, you're expected to pay an 11% tax on an item you didn't purchase in Massachusetts.
Right.
Which, I don't know who wrote that, but I mean, that's just a loss. That's an additional lawsuit waiting to happen.
Exactly.
An additional complaint.
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the funny things. So if you live in northern Massachusetts and you go up to New Hampshire, a lot of times you'll see people purchasing like large ticket items in New Hampshire, like, you know, Best Buy on the Salem line used to be pretty busy, and it used to have a parking lot full of Massachusetts license plates, and you know, just to avoid the sales tax. But this is something that in previous, I know we were talking about it a few minutes ago, but this is a perennially filed bill. This is something that gets filed every session by this particular state rep. And, this provision has been a part of it. But now that you have to register your firearms under Chapter 135 of the Acts of 2024 of last year's big omnibus bill, they can now put that into effect if they decide to do this. So that's really the big change that I think has really come from this bill. I mean, you've always had to report your transactions, but you know, selling person to person, you didn't always have to do that in Massachusetts, but now that's kind of the big difference. So I'm wondering if that's what the renewed focus on this is for or about.
I'm wondering that too. And then also maybe the fact that the California law is now in effect. Has provided additional impetus. Maybe this representative can now point to that and say, look, we're not the only state doing this.
Right.
We're not the only one who's come up with this idea.
Yeah. And this is her fourth time filing this bill. And another reason why we were kind of skeptical about what kind of energy this had behind it, Senator Cindy Cream, who is the Senate Majority Leader, you know, just for perspective for people who don't know much about Massachusetts legislature, there's five Republicans in the Senate out of 40. So Cindy Cream is the next level down from the Senate president, and she's really in charge of the Democratic caucus. So she has, you know, essentially 34 people under her.
Okay.
So what she files gets more attention. This bill had her version of it. It's called an act to fund programs to reduce violence and firearm related injuries. Her version, she has no co-sponsors, and we heard nothing from her staff about this or anything before it came to the Committee on Public Safety and Homeland Security back in September. So we just kind of said, okay, we're gonna just be quiet about this one and just hope that it goes the way of the buffalo that it usually goes every session. But, you know, but Representative Mindy Dom's version has gotten a little more attention. So we're, you know, it's back on the radar for us. So we're kind of looking at it.
You know, I mean, just from a broader perspective, you know, you talk about Chapter 135. We're going to get into some of the lawsuits that Tagola is involved in. I mean, this was such a big gun control bill. Is there, I mean, obviously, you know, you've got a lot of anti-gun politicians in the legislature, but given the scope and the just the depth of all of these new gun control laws that were put in place pretty recently.
Yeah.
Do you think the legislature is eager to go back to this? Well, I mean, I don't.
This is kind of one of those things where we're, you know, we don't have a lot of faith in the legislature to do the right thing
right.
most of the time. However, their Chapter 135 was so vast and so broadly effective. Like it touched firearms ownership and usage from top to bottom, from all the way up to self-defense and hunting, all the way down to just simple possession regulations. That everything, all of the controversial portions of it have had some sort of challenge from us or an FFL or COM2A or a national group. And the stuff that they've looked, that the legislature has looked at, and the executive branch have looked at, that they don't think they'd be able to implement in time, they've already passed legislation to delay. I mean, their numbers give them the agility in the legislature to do that.
Right.
So a lot of the things that we've challenged and that they've kind of moved on, they've adjusted for. And there's other bills that are kind of moving around to do that as well. So I don't know if there's a hunger on the legislature side to make it more complicated. And I know for a fact that folks in the governor's office and in the different secretariats that are touched by this have no appetite for additional regulations that they're going to have to then figure out.
Okay, like they've got enough on their plate with 135.
Exactly. I mean, okay. barring some push from some outside political force, I don't really see this thing moving. But again, it's been a very odd last couple of years. The board has kind of been pushed off the table. So,
yeah,
you know, we're picking up the pieces at this point.
Right. Well, I mean, at least, and you know, it's good to know that you guys are aware of this. You know, if it does start moving, then I'm sure that you'll be alerting your members. But
oh yeah, I mean, what else can they do? I mean, how much more can they get from us? They've squeezed us to the point of just snapping all the bones.
It gets us to 135 and how many lawsuits is Goal involved in regarding the various aspects of 135? Because there's no way to just challenge the whole thing, right? You got to challenge these separate components. That's the way that they wrote this bill.
Exactly. And the other part of it is, even the portions that we challenged right off the bat, you know, the licensing scheme and the new training requirements,
right.
They passed a bill within a week of our lawsuit being filed to delay that for 18 months.
Yeah.
So it rendered it moot. So we had to withdraw our lawsuit. It was without prejudice, so we could bring it again if we needed to. But we're not going to see what the curriculum or the new training requirements look like until April.
Of next
so,
year.
of next, you have April 2026. Yeah, so we're kind of sitting on that one. We have it ready to go. Obviously, it's already been drafted. It's already been filed once before.
Right.
But you know, so we have that one in the hopper. We have another bill challenging the licensing delays, both before Chapter 135 and those created by Chapter 135 for in-state applicants. And then we have another one challenging the delays for under similar circumstances for out-of-state applicants. Speaking of out-of-state applicants, we have a gentleman named Kyle Collada who's been in jail for 103 days, I think, at this point, with no bail for a simple possession charge. We hired an attorney for him, Dan Hagen, out of Springfield. He is a he might be somebody fun to have on the show. He's kind of a newcomer to 2A law. He's a little bit younger.
Okay.
And his approach has been. But, I think I hit the wire on my microphone. I'm so sorry. Sorry,
Kim. It's okay.
When did I lose you?
You're talking about Dan Hagen. You said
he's kind of a newcomer to 2A law, but he is a true believer. We just voted him onto the goal board, and he's doing a lot of interesting things for 2A law in Mass. It's really cool. It's a fun thing to be involved in at the moment.
Yeah.
So he's Kyle's lawyer, and he got all of the larger charges dismissed, like the large capacity stuff, the assault weapon stuff. So he's just – so as of this point, as of that negotiation, Kyle Collada is sitting in jail on a simple possession without a license charge for 103 days.
Right? That's the thing, right? This was a –
yes.
Yeah. Simply, again, a simple possession. Right? And these are guns that he legally owned. And we talked with Jim about this case, but for folks who maybe aren't familiar or forgot, Kyle and his girlfriend had moved from Arizona to Massachusetts to be closer, I believe, to her family.
Yeah, they were on their way to New Hampshire, actually.
Okay. So they're essentially living out of their car. They're making money door dashing, right? He has these firearms that are legally owned. The car, I think, was pulled over for lack of registration, tag or something, right?
Yeah.
He informs the officer, yes, I have firearms in the car. And that's when the trouble began, right? And that's when he gets arrested for, you know, possessing a so-called assault weapon, large capacity magazines, gets put in jail. Again, that dangerousness hearing is held. He's ruled to be dangerous. By the way, like a week later, there was a guy in, I think it was Boston, the road rage incident, right? You remember this, right?
Shot at a pregnant woman.
Yeah. And he wasn't dangerous. He got out. He was able to post bond. But Kyle Collada, as you say, has been in prison or been in jail for, almost 4 months.
On illegal fiction.
Yeah. And now, as you say, all those other additional charges wiped away. So he's just charged with simply possessing a firearm without a Massachusetts license. Which makes you dangerous enough to be held without held without bond. I mean, that is absolutely insane.
Yeah, it's wild. So, and Jim keeps saying, you know, so one of the things we were talking about was like, listen, this guy he's guilty of being poor and wanting to exercise his Second Amendment rights at the same time. That's insane. But, you know, we keep saying like, this is kind of ground zero for this stuff. This is the case. Like, this is a simple possession case. Like, this is fundamentally like, does the Second Amendment apply across the country? it's upsetting, and it doesn't make any sense. And it feels political at this point. He's kind of just a political prisoner.
Right. I absolutely. And, you know, I mean, I know that there are some other cases involving non-residents and, having to get a non-resident permit, which is not easy to do. It's not cheap. It doesn't last very long, and it takes months and months to get it. But again, like, if you're somebody who, you know, is just essentially passing through, right, you're going to be in the state maybe for a day, maybe even less than a day. You're just trying to make enough gas money and maybe money to put you in a hotel at night. You're guilty of exercising your, as you say, you're guilty of exercising your Second Amendment rights in a state that doesn't want you to.
Exactly.
That's it.
Yeah. And I mean, we've seen directives from coming directly out of the DA's offices saying, hey, we're not no, we're no longer going easy on possession cases for out-of-state folks. We've seen it in black and white. I mean, Marion Ryan's office, it just out of Middlesex County, which is the largest county in Massachusetts. It's insane. The level of disdain they have for us is really starting to show.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm glad that Gold got involved in this case. You know, talking to Jim, he said, yeah, you know, Gold does not typically get involved in individual cases like this. I mean, if you did, you guys would be overwhelmed, right? But
exactly,
this was so egregious. By all accounts, Kyle is a good guy who just, you know, caught up in bad circumstances.
He's a veteran. He's a no other charges. It makes no sense.
Yeah, it doesn't. So if folks want to help out, I mean, do you guys have like a legal defense fund set up for him? Can you just donate to Gold and say, hey, I want this money to go towards his defense?
So we fronted the retainer already. We've already done that. And I don't see Dan. I mean, I'm not going to speak for him, but I don't think we've run through that already. But
okay.
Gold.org, I mean, most of the funds that we're taking in at this point are going toward our legal cases. Okay. That's kind of become our focus beyond lobbying. I mean, since COVID, nobody's really in the State House building anymore. I mean, they could turn that thing into condos. I don't think anyone would notice. But, you know, our focus has kind of shifted toward a lawsuit model. And that's really where we're heading. That's where the majority of our funds are going. It's what our membership wanted. It's what we're seeing to be more effective. I mean, even just the tiny wins that we're not seeing in court. Mm-hmm. Like I said earlier, I mean, the case we filed to challenge the new training requirements, it forced them to respond and delay them 18 months. I mean, it's a Pyrrhic victory, I'm sure, but it's still, we still made them flinch on that stuff. So even tiny stuff like that is a win.
Yeah. Well, and there is the ballot initiative that's going to be on the ballot in November of next year, right?
November 3rd, 2026. Yes. Okay. And vote no. That's the other side of this thing that is that's kind of putting us at a disadvantage, is where we have to tell people to vote no.
To vote no.
It's no, we do not want to keep the law, is the way that it's phrased. Yeah. That's I know.
But I assume that, you know, over the next 12 months, you guys will be ramping up your grassroots efforts to get people mobilized.
Working with Toby and those guys. Working with Toby and those guys over at the Coalition, making sure that they have the support that they need from us. And we met with them last week to kind of go over messaging and what the media strategy is going to be. And, you know, we're on weekly calls with those guys, too. So we're attacking this at all fronts. And thank God town meeting season is over, so we don't have to worry about zoning regulations and all that stuff for a little while, too, because that's a whole nother front that nobody ever thinks about, that we're dealing with this stuff, too.
Did you get through that unscathed? Were there some towns that put new restrictions in place?
So we actually came through it on a positive note. So there's a provision in Chapter 135 where all town and local buildings are presumed to be sensitive places, but your town, through a vote of the Board of Selectmen or your city council or your town meeting, can vote to opt out of that provision of Chapter 135. And I think we had 10 communities that voted the right way this last town meeting season, because it's always a crapshoot. You know, you grew up in Massachusetts. You can load those town meetings up with whoever you want. So if you're if the word gets out to the wrong group, like you're going to lose your vote. But if it gets out to the right group, you're automatically going to win. You know, open town meeting, it's a circus, man.
Well, I'm glad that there's some positive news there.
And yeah, it's good. We're seeing some good stuff come out of the locals.
That is very good to hear. All right, Mike, listen, man, I appreciate you joining us on the program today. It was always good to catch up. I was glad to see you back in April, and I'm sorry I missed you at Gun Rights Policy Conference. But
no worries. It was good to see you on video, though, man.
Well, I appreciate that, and hopefully I'll be up that way again here before long. But thank you and all the folks at Gold for keeping up the Second Amendment fight there in Massachusetts.
Doing our best. Thanks for having me, Cam. Appreciate
Absolutely, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Take it easy.
My thanks to Mike for joining us on the program. Looking forward to having him back here again before long. We need to talk with Toby Leary, too, now that we are, about a month away, or excuse me, about a year away from the referendum to repeal Chapter 135. Right now, though, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a disturbing case out of Connecticut, where police say a man killed his parents in a double shooting. He has a long criminal history, which begs the question, why was he out? 25-year-old Javian Adams is now facing multiple charges, including murder with special circumstances, reckless endangerment, and criminal possession of a firearm, meaning he was not legally allowed to own a firearm, and Connecticut's very restrictive gun control laws did not prevent him from illegally acquiring one, according to authorities. A judge has set his bond at $6 million. During a press conference yesterday, police identified the victims as 52-year-old Carlene Williams and 55-year-old Mark Adams, both residents of Waterbury, Connecticut. Officers found them inside their home with gunshot wounds. They're pronounced dead at the scene. Authorities say that the younger Adams, Javian Adams, has a, quote, significant history of domestic violence. He was actually on probation for earlier convictions, but they didn't detail how many previous convictions we're talking about here. They did say, though, that he was actually arrested at first in connection with a burglary in Watertown, Connecticut, and then tied back to the murders of his parents after that unrelated arrest for burglary. Both the burglary, I guess, and the homicides remain under investigation. But again, the suspect in this case, well known to authorities long before this double murder took place, well known to the judicial system long before these double murders took place. And again, according to authorities, he was actively on probation, which means that there was an opportunity to put Mr. Adams behind bars for one of those, one or more of those previous incidents of domestic violence, instead of giving him a slap on the wrist and returning him to the streets. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story. Now, this is an unusual one from a WAFB in Louisiana. Person shot while trying to set house on fire with someone inside. You know, typically when we talk about defensive gun uses, we're talking about people who've already made their way inside a home, right? A late night break-in. I mean, it doesn't have to be late night. But, you know, a carjacker, somebody who's, you know, actively gained entrance to where someone, where that lawful gun owner happens to be. In this case, this was a self-defense shooting from inside the home to someone outside. According to the Livingston Parish Sheriff's Office, authorities dispatched to the scene of a shooting in the Albany, Louisiana area around 3 p.m. This past Tuesday. One person treated for a gunshot wound to the leg. Another person was detained for questioning. And then yesterday, the sheriff's office announced that the investigation points to the shooter acting in self-defense. Sheriff Jason Ard says, during our investigation, it was learned that prior to being shot, the person with the gunshot wound had poured gasoline on the house floor and was attempting to set it ablaze with someone inside. The shot was fired in an attempt to stop that from happening. According to the sheriff, the person who was shot is stable and will be charged with attempted aggravated arson after being released from the hospital. Investigation is ongoing, but again, at this point, the shooter not facing any charges. And maybe all of this did actually take place inside the home after learning some of these details, but it is still unusual. You know, most of the time, again, we're dealing with an armed intruder or at least somebody who is, you know, physically beating somebody. This is one of the few, if not the first, defensive gun use that I can recall in, you know, 21 years of covering armed citizen stories where the lawful gun owner was acting to protect themselves from somebody who is attempting to set them and their house on fire. But we'll keep our eyes open for any more details, and hopefully, hopefully this isn't the start of a trend. I mean, it would be a good trend, I guess, if we're talking about people acting in self-defense in those situations, but hopefully not a trend of people trying to set other people's houses on fire. Finally today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Some individuals in Sacramento who came together to help save a medical crew after a helicopter crash. Again, I mean, you want to talk about a scary moment here. This was, I guess, earlier this week. The helicopter crashed on a freeway Kenneth DiCrescenzo and his wife said they were just seconds away from this helicopter going down. And Ken and his neighbor, Elvin, ran towards the wreckage. He said, when it was coming down, I looked at it and I said, this isn't good. He said, but when people were needed, they all stepped up. Everybody that was nearby and heard this man's voice knew that they just moved forward and started to go to work so they could hear someone from inside that wreckage. DiCrescenzo said he and his neighbor didn't think twice before running to help. He said, you know, something happened here. This is an emergency. They need help. Just step in and do it. It needs to be done. His wife, Terry, was helping at the scene, but also whipped out her phone to capture what was going on. She said, we were in the right place at the right time. She also credited first responders for getting there quickly. Kenneth DiCrescenzo said the responders got there really, really quickly. The fire department was right there, right away. Highway Patrol was right on top of it. Again, several crew members of that helicopter trapped underneath the wreckage, but these bystanders were essentially able to lift that helicopter off of her. She was severely injured. At least one individual was severely injured, identified as a Susie Smith. Her family told ABC 10 that they are, quote, praying for a miracle as she continues to recover from what's described as severe injuries. Meanwhile, Terry DiCrescenzo says, you know, one human being helping another, group of human beings helping one another. She says, it's nice to know that it's still like that. And I think that it is still like that. I mean, obviously, you know, that's why I do this segment every day that we do a Cam and Company, because the news is full of people acting horribly. And it can be really easy to get a warped sense of reality and believe that everybody's horrible. Right. That we don't have people among us who are doing the right thing for the right reasons. But no, there are plenty of people who are in the right place at the right time and are willing to do the right thing when needed. And that would include this group there in Sacramento, California. All right. That is going to do it, though, for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program, as always. Be sure to check out the website, BearingArms.com. Today, Friday, over the course of the weekend, we're going to keep you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. We may even go a little further afield and talk about the gun confiscation efforts going on in Canada, the pilot program underway in Nova Scotia, and there were protests last weekend. We'll see if anything pops up this weekend as well. But we've got you covered, again, with all the latest legislative news, litigation, which is keeping us very busy these days, regulation. Even the culture war attacks on our right to keep and bear arms. We're covering all of it for you there at Bearing Arms. And if you like what you see, I would encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. While the government shutdown is still underway, Town Hall is running a great deal. Use the promo code POTUS47 and you can get 74% off of your VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum membership. You get all kinds of great benefits at every level of support, but whichever one you choose, I want to thank you for your support because it really does mean a lot. So, again, we really appreciate it, and thanks very much. All right. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday. Until then, be well. Be safe. And be free.